The headlines: Iran slams the U.S. and Israel for their involvement in the assassination of the top Iranian officials and the West's support for anti-Tehran terror groups. New report describes an extrajudicial execution, the last year's killing of a Palestinian man who was left by Israeli forces to bleed to death. Also in the headlines, Ghana becomes the first country in the world to receive the coronavirus vaccine shots under the World Health Organization's COVAX scheme. Thanks for joining us. The head of Iranian Judiciary's High Council for Human Rights says U.S. sanctions have grossly violated the absolute rights of the Iranian people to have access to humanitarian aid.
I speak of a nation whose absolute right, including the right to health, the right to food, the right of access to humanitarian aid, and the right of access to peaceful nuclear technology have been grossly violated by the illegal sanctions imposed by the U.S. regime and its implementations by a number of Western countries. But there
is much Ali Baghdadi Khani was speaking at a high-level session of the U.N. or Human Rights Council in Geneva. He noted that sanctions have even deprived Iran of purchasing medicines for children suffering from butterfly disease. Baghdadi Khani said the so-called maximum pressure campaign launched by the former U.S. administration has led to the maximum violation of the rights of Iranians. He slammed, as politically motivated, the claims of human rights violations made by some Western countries against Iran. Further in his remarks, Baghdadi Khani lashed out at the U.S. and Israel for assassinating the country's top general, Qasem Soleimani, and nuclear scientist Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. He said that such murders show that Iran pays the price for fighting terrorism.
The assassination of the greatest defender of the right of nations in the region against terrorism, General Qasem Soleimani, by the U.S. regime, and the assassination of our scientists of the field of peaceful nuclear science and technology, including martyr Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, by the Zionist regime, are but a portion of expenses paid by the Iranian people in the fight against terrorism. I speak of a nation whose...
Baghdadi Khani further said that Iran has been at the forefront of the fight against terrorism. He added that some Western countries have praised the notorious anti-Tehran terror group, the MKO, which has killed thousands of innocent people. A new forensic report has questioned an Israeli narrative of last year's shooting death of a Palestinian man in the occupied West Bank, calling it an extrajudicial execution. Ahmed Arakat was shot at a checkpoint to the city of Bethlehem in June 2020. Israeli forces then claimed that Arakat was shot after he attempted to ram his vehicle into a soldier. But Forensic Architecture, a London-based group specializing in the investigation of violations of human rights, says the 27-year-old posed no threat to Israeli soldiers or to any property. The report by the group says the victim was also not given any first aid treatment and was left to bleed to death for more than an hour. Arakat's family has now appealed to the international community to help secure the release of his body, which remains with Israel. The UN says Israeli forces have enjoyed persistent impunity for using excessive force against Palestinian people in the occupied West Bank.
We also continue to observe persistent impunity afforded to members of the Israeli security forces for incidents of possible excessive use of force in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem. In the rare cases where convictions have been secured, the charges and sentences have appeared extremely lenient given the gravity of the conduct. Similarly, there was no notable progress in the...
Addressing the Human Rights Council, Michelle Bachelet said that Israeli forces had killed 67 Palestinians, including 16 children, between November 2019 and October 2020. She added that nearly 3,700 others were also injured during the same period. She also criticized Tel Aviv for the lack of notable progress in investigating allegations of ill treatment and the torture of Palestinians in Israeli jails. Bachelet said that there have been no charges brought against Israelis involved in rights violations. The UN official called on the international community to hold to account those responsible for such violations and to provide redress to victims. Okay, back to our story regarding our previous story, that is. This is about how a new forensic report has said that the narrative that Israel gave about a particular Palestinian is not the right one. Mona Kandil is our correspondent joining us from occupied Ramallah. Mona, first of all, maybe you can recount very shortly what that incident involved and why there is now a contradiction on the Israeli narrative of the story.
Well, back in June 2020, this Palestinian young man, Ahmed Arikat, was shot by the Israeli forces while he was driving his vehicle at the Israeli military checkpoint, known as the container between Bethlehem and Jerusalem. Al-Quds, of course, Israeli forces order the vehicles at every checkpoint to stop and to be searched. This is what happened. Ahmed Arikat stopped his vehicle. However, when the soldier ordered him to continue driving, suddenly they opened fire, killing him. The Israeli soldiers at the checkpoint claimed that he tried to carry out an anti-Israel operation or tried to hit the soldiers there by his vehicle. However, his relatives and all people know Ahmed said that Ahmed was on his way to a beauty salon to get his mom and sister for the wedding of another sister on the same day. And his wedding was supposed to be 2 weeks later. So it was no way for Ahmed to carry out an anti-Israeli operation at that time. However, the Israeli forces, it's very easy for them, according to human rights organizations and experts, to use their weapon. They have orders to use the policy of shooting to kill Palestinians instead of shooting the people and apprehending them. At the same time, Ahmed was left for hours bleeding without allowing the medical, the Palestinian medics to help him. All this proved that it was a killing on purpose. He posed no threat to any of the soldiers or the property. Now his family are demanding Israeli authorities, and they are demanding actually the international community to force the Israeli regime to release the body of Ahmed Arikat to get a proper funeral and burial.
Thank you very much for that. From occupied Ramallah, Mona Kandil talking to us there. Many thanks. The U.S. says it intends to return to the Geneva-based United Nations Human Rights Council to eliminate, quote, disproportionate focus on Israel.
We need to eliminate Agenda Item 7 and treat the human rights situation in Israel and the Palestinian territories the same way as this body handles any other country.
The top U.S. diplomat also said that Washington would seek a seat on the UNHRC panel for the 2022-2024 term. Blinken urged member states to support Washington's bid. He also called on the UN body to change its stance on Washington's key ally, Israel. That is while the UN adopted 17 resolutions in 2020 against Israel for its violations, including those in the Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank. Elections for membership on the 47-member council are due at the UN General Assembly in October. The former U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew his country from the rights body, accusing it of displaying hostility toward Israel. The World Health Organization has delivered the COVID-19 vaccine shipment to Ghana, making it the first country in the world to receive shots under the organization's COVAX scheme. A flight carrying 600,000 doses of AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine produced by an Indian firm landed in Ghana's capital, Accra. Local representatives of the WHO and the United Nations Children's Agency have described the vaccine's arrival as, quote, momentous occasion. They also called the move a critical step in bringing the pandemic to an end. The UN-backed COVAX initiative, which was launched eight months ago, aims to ensure a fair distribution of vaccines between the rich and poor nations. Under the COVAX program, the UN Health Agency is expected to deliver some 2 billion doses of COVID vaccines to member states by the end of the year. At least 16 people have been killed and over 50 injured in an attack by the Boko Haram terrorist group in Nigeria's northeastern state of Borno. Security forces say that the terrorists fired two mortar shells on the densely populated city of Maiduguri. Nine of the dead were young boys who were hit while playing football. Boko Haram has repeatedly made incursions into Maiduguri, aiming to overrun the regional capital. Since gaining widespread exposure in 2009, the terrorist group has killed over 36,000 people and displaced around 2 million from their homes in Nigeria. The Boko Haram insurgency has caused a dire humanitarian crisis in the region, including neighboring Niger, Chad, and Cameroon. Authorities in the U.S. state of Texas say that around 3.4 million people still face disrupted water supplies following a deadly winter storm last week. Authorities said that over 200 counties were reporting water issues as of Tuesday evening. The number was much lower compared to Monday, when over 7.9 million people faced water disruptions. The freezing weather conditions left dozens dead and knocked out power stations in Texas. It took several days for the authorities to restore power. Fresh water and food have been distributed to residents, with long queues formed in some locations to receive the supplies. President of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro, has accused the U.S. and its allies of deepening the economic crisis in the South American country by imposing illegal sanctions. Legal experts say that such sanctions amount to crimes against innocent people. From Caracas, Jesus Silva has more.
Delivering a speech at the 46th session of the Human Rights Council of the United Nations, Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro denounced the damaging effects of ongoing illegal sanctions by the U.S. and its allies against the Bolivarian Republic. Maduro outlined that Washington, following its regime change policy, leads a coalition of states that the European Union is part of, which is implementing a long series of punishing measures to deliberately bring about a humanitarian crisis in Venezuela and overthrow his administration. Maduro mentioned details of these measures.
Through illegal measures, Venezuela has been deprived of $30 billion in cash, which are part of the assets of the Republic abroad.
In this light, the socialist president strongly condemned the U.S. government and its allies over their abusive actions against the Venezuelan people.
Those who have taken away Venezuelan assets and resources have shown their cruelty, even worse at a time of a pandemic.
Although some opposition figures in Venezuela argue that the U.S. sanctions are a needed political tool to force anticipated elections in the Latin American country, legal analysts say that such sanctions are totally illegal and unacceptable.
What the U.S. is doing to our nation violates international law and all human rights instruments. There is no way to justify such a crime.
President Maduro denounced over 450 illegal sanctions U.S. and its allies imposed on Venezuela. Maduro pointed out that despite the massive economic aggression, his socialist government will not be overthrown. Jesus Silva, Caracas.
Clashes have erupted in the Bolivian capital La Paz between police and medics during a protest against a new health emergency law. Riot police fired tear gas to scatter protesters who demanded the repeal of the controversial legislation. Health workers have been on a strike across Bolivia since Friday to show their opposition. The law bans medical staff from taking job action during the coronavirus pandemic. It also allows the hiring of foreign doctors and nurses. The protesters say that the move is unconstitutional and restricts the right to protest. The COVID-19 outbreak has pushed many hospitals in Bolivia to the brink of collapse. The Andean country has so far reported nearly 250,000 infections and more than 11,000 deaths. Protesters have once again taken to the streets in Myanmar to denounce a military coup that ousted the country's de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi. Hundreds gathered in Mandalay, the largest city Yangon, chanting slogans against the military. Protests have continued unabated for more than 2 weeks in defiance of enhanced security measures by the military. A civil disobedience campaign has continued. People want civilian leaders to be reinstated and detained officials to be released. Myanmar's army seized power on February the 1st. It alleged fraud in November elections, in which Suu Kyi's party won against a pro-military party. So far, three protesters have been killed and hundreds arrested. Nay Sun Win, the coordinator of the Free Rohingya Coalition, says that a major goal of the protesters in Myanmar is to change the current constitution that gives power to the military.
The protests are increasing day by day, and across the country, millions of people are taken to the street, and they are protesting against this military coup. They don't want this military dictatorship at all. And also, most of them agree to demand to abolish the 2008 constitution, which was created by this military regime in 2008. Now the trend is they are targeting to abolish this constitution, which will enable the equal rights, justice for all, because this constitution is controlling by the military, and they are sharing the 25% seats at the parliament, and also the some ministry. The minister needs to be appointed by the commander in chief, and they are from the military. So I think the movement they call the Myanmar Early Spring Revolution, this will be, if they go continuously like now, I think the military will not last this time.
Turkey has criticized the EU's double standard of supporting Greece and the issue of migrants, but not sharing responsibility for 4 million refugees hosted by Turkey, the Russian Sagalan reports.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan slammed EU countries over their refugee policies and criticized the bloc's double standards in dealing with the migrant crisis. Erdogan said EU fully supports Greece on this issue, however fails to share responsibility with Turkey for 4 million refugees. Speaking at a migration conference in the city of Izmir, Erdogan said EU offered Greece 3 billion euros for 100,000 refugees, while it failed to fulfill its promise to transfer 6 billion euros to Turkey, which hosts 4 million refugees as part of 2016 Migration Pact.
İnsanlık sadece Akdeniz'de değil.
Humanity has failed migrants not only in the Mediterranean, but also in the Aegean and Meriç River along the Turkish-Greek border.
In 2016, Ankara and Brussels signed an agreement which grants Turkey a total of 6 billion euros as fund. In return, Ankara promised to reduce the number of refugees influx to EU countries. Turkey says it was committed to its part of the deal. However, EU failed to keep its promise.
Turkish President's comments come amid the EU's reluctance to fulfill its promises. Turkey has to accommodate 4 million Syrian refugees. This has put a huge pressure on the country.
Turkey and Greece have been considered key transit points for refugees from Syria to Europe. Many were able to reach European countries like Sweden and Germany, while others unfortunately lost their lives trying to get to a safe haven. As observers say, the only loser in the fight over the migrant issue between Ankara and Brussels seems to be the refugees themselves, with many men, women and children dying each year trying to cross to Europe. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
And that is it for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Labour MPs are being asked by the party's high command not to focus on problems caused by Brexit when asking questions in Parliament. dealing with the media, a posting on social media, according to sources in the Parliamentary Labour Party. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Observer's political editor, Toby Helm. The piece is titled, Labour MPs Dismay at Orders to Maintain Radio Silence on Brexit. Stay with us for more of Toby Helm's article. Labour MPs are being asked by the party's high command not to focus on problems caused by Brexit when asking questions in the House of Commons, dealing with the media, or posting on social media, according to sources in the Parliamentary Labour Party. After a week in which Labour leader Keir Starmer delivered a major speech on how the country should rebuild the economy and reduce inequality without once mentioning Brexit, relations with the European Union or the severe problems that have confronted many UK exporters since 1st of January, senior party figures reacted with astonishment. On Saturday night, former cabinet member and Europe Minister Peter Hain said Brexit had become the elephant in the room for Labour. Peter Hain told The Observer, "It's quite understandable that Brexit has not been top of Labour's agenda, but it's not sustainable to ignore this elephant in the room hurting British businesses, our vital performing arts sector, our security and our foreign policy reach." The Tories delivered a last-minute mess of a Brexit with a damaging consequences, not least to stability on the island of Ireland. One senior backbencher said the message from the top was very clear, that there should be virtual radio silence on the issue of Brexit. The order that is coming out is, don't mention the war. We're being told that Keir Starmer wants to move on, and that if we mention the B word, let alone suggest we need a better deal with the European Union than Boris Johnson's, we are being unhelpful. Several sources said the MP Carolyn Harris, Keir Starmer's parliamentary aide with responsibility for coordinating with Labour members, including on what questions they ask at Prime Minister's question time, had been discouraging interventions on Brexit, saying they would damage the leader. With difficulties for British exporters continuing and problems over the Irish protocol unresolved, one member of Keir Starmer's front bench team said, attempts to brush the problems under the carpet just because we wrongly voted for Boris Johnson's deal in December is pretty close to negligence. He added that Keir Starmer was terrified of offending voters in red wall seats in the Midlands and the North, where pro-Brexit voters deserted Labour at the 2019 election. Since 1st of January, Keir Starmer has not raised Brexit on or problems caused by Brexit once at Prime Minister's question time, and interventions on the issue from backbenchers have been rare. None of the shadow cabinet or frontbench team have made a speech in Parliament on the issues affecting UK businesses. Pressure is now building on Labour leader Keir Starmer and his shadow cabinet to lay out a vision of how he would try to improve access to the European Union single market, the UK's biggest export market, after it emerged that thousands of British firms that export to the bloc are struggling with extra costs and extra bureaucracy, driving many to invest in warehouses and subsidiaries on the continent while scaling down and laying off staff in the United Kingdom. At a special meeting of the parliamentary party before Keir Starmer's speech, Neil Coyle, the MP for Bermondsey and Old Southwark, said Labour should make a land grab to become the party of business, given how damaging Brexit had been to trade. Neil Coyle called for an extension of a theme in Starmer's speech about a new partnership with business to cover the immediate concerns of every industry, from fishing to finance, as a result of the severe limitations of the government's trade deal with the European Union. Former Transport Secretary Andrew Adonis said it was incredible that Starmer had chosen not to mention Brexit in his speech. Keir Starmer's speech on the economic challenges ahead didn't once mention the words Brexit, trade, or Europe. This is unsustainable. It's like discussing the weather without mentioning the wind and the rain. Referring to Starmer's plan for a recovery bond, he added, "The best British recovery bond would be to rejoin the European Customs Union and single market as soon as possible. Slashing our trade and raising prices at this moment is disastrous. The crisis Britain faces isn't its capacity to borrow, which has never been cheaper, but rather mass unemployment and an economic slump. Brexit is a major cause of both. Labour won't be credible until it promises to fundamentally renegotiate Boris Johnson's damaging trade reduction treaty with Europe." Meanwhile, the Green Party's Caroline Lucas, whose party has shown some signs of pushing up in the opinion polls in recent weeks, said, "It beggars belief that in his much-trailed reset speech on business and the economy, the leader of the opposition, Keir Starmer, himself once the most pro-European member of the shadow cabinet, couldn't even bring himself to mention the B word even once."
First methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri wa salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Salamun Alaikum. Now we invite you to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I would like to take this opportunity to remind ourselves of the universal personality of Ali ibn Abi Talib. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala had blessed the Prophet of Islam with two major miracles. One is known as the Quran, and the other is in a human form known as Ali ibn Abi Talib. Quran is the message of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Ali is the embodiment of that message. Quran is immune from error. Ali is also infallible and ma'soom. The first formal declaration made by the Prophet introducing Islam is also the same gathering in which the Prophet introduced Ali when he says the words, "Hadha akhi wa wasi wa khalifati," that he is my brother and he is my successor. And the last formal declaration of the Prophet of Islam was in Ghadir. And there also, interestingly, he talks about two important things that he leaves behind as sources of guidance. One is the Quran, and the other is the Itra and the Ahlul Bayt, and Ali is the head of the Ahlul Bayt. And so when we look at Quran as a universal book whose message is not in any way bound to time and space, and people of all eras and all parts of the world will be able to gain guidance from its teachings. Similarly, Ali is universal, in a sense that his life and his words and in his examples and how he conducted himself is not bound to time and space. People of all eras and all places of the world will be able to gain guidance from the life and the examples of Ali bin Abi Talib. Talking about the universal personality of Ali bin Abi Talib, let me zero down on one value from his life, and maybe we will dedicate tonight's talk on this issue. And this is the sense of justice that Amir al-Mu'minin had. Remember, when we talk about the concept of peace, all people around the world these days, they want peace. Whether they are from the east or the west or the north or south, or rich or poor, white or black, doesn't matter. But the problem is that people many times do not realize that peace is not the beginning of a process. It is actually the end result of another more important value known as justice. There can be no peace without justice. While describing the purpose of sending the prophets and messengers to this world, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, in chapter 57, verse number 25, clarifies this and talks about it very clearly, where he says, لَقَدْ أَرْسَلْنَا رُسُلُنَا بِالْبَيِّنَاتِ وَأَنزَلْنَا مَعَهُمَ الْكِتَابَ وَالْمِيزَانِ. He says, certainly we sent our messengers with clear proofs, and we sent down with them the book and the balance. For what? لِيَقُومَ النَّاسِ بِالْقِسْطِ, so that the people may maintain justice. And this is where we have to realize that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala talks about sending kitab and mizan, the book, which will be the source of identifying what is right and what is wrong. And when he talks about mizan, he's talking about justice. You know, and sometimes even this sword need to be used in order to implement justice in society. And that's when you will be able to, maintain justice in the society. And so when we talk about, you know, this issue from the Quranic point of view, we come to realize that the purpose of the prophets and messengers of God was to maintain justice in human society on the basis of the Kitab and the Mizan. From the perspective of Ali bin Abi Talib, it's an extension of the Quranic teaching, where we see that if you look at the phenomenon of government, what is governance? For Ali, government is not an end by itself, but it's a means. It's a means of maintaining justice in society. In Ali's perspective, basically, as the Quran, says, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala commands those who are ruling over others, إِنَّ اللَّهَ يَأْمُرُكُمْ أَن تُؤَدُّوا الْأَمَانَاتِ إِلَىٰ أَهْلِهَا وَإِذَا حَكَمْتُمْ بَيْنَ النَّاسِ أَن تَحْكُمُوا بِالْعَدْلِ. Surah An-Nisa, Surah number 4, ayat 58, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that, you know, verily Allah commands you to fulfill the trust to those who are the owners of it. And what is that trust? He says, and when you rule among the people, you rule among them on the basis of justice. And so if any government or ruler is not able to implement justice in the society and among the citizens, then that ruler is not worthy of that position, because he's not able to fulfill the amanat, the trust that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given in his hand. Look at the example how he, you know, talks about this role of and the purpose of a government. When Ali alayhi salam was marching with his army from Medina towards Basra to deal with this rebellion in Basra, his army stopped in a place called Rabza. And there was a caravan of the pilgrims, the Hujjaj, passing by. And when they were told that this is the campsite of Ali bin Abi Talib and his army, they had this desire to go and see their Khalifa, their ruler, their Imam. And so they went to the campsite of Ali, and they said, we would like to see Ali. At that time, Abdullah ibn Abbas, who was the cousin and a close companion of Amir al-Mu'mineen, and his relationship with Ali was very informal. They were very, free to one another. And so Abdullah ibn Abbas went to the tent of Amir al-Mu'mineen, and he saw that the imam of the time, the ruler of the Muslims at the time, was sitting on the floor and mending the strap of his sandal by himself, stitching it himself. Abdullah ibn Abbas was in a way surprised, and he told Ali that, there are Muslims sitting outside to see you. Probably, your time can be used more in a more productive manner by meeting them than what you are doing. From the worldly point of view, we will say he's the ruler of the time. Just he should have given it to somebody, a worker in his administration, to get it fixed. Amir al-Mu'minin did not respond to Abdullah ibn Abbas right away. He continued his work of stitching the strap of his sandal. Once he has done it, he put it there by the other the pair there. And then he asked Ibn Abbas, قَوِّمَهَا. Oh, Ibn Abbas, قَوِّمَهَا. What is the worth of this pair of sandals? How much will you give it to me? For how much will you buy this? Abdullah ibn Abbas said nothing. It has no worth at all. I wouldn't pay anything for it. And Amir al-Mu'mineen says, still give me a figure. That's where Abdullah ibn Abbas says, kasru dirham, less than a dirham. Response of Amir al-Mu'mineen here is something you can never forget. He says, wallahi, lahuma ahabbu ilayya min amrikum hadha illa an uqima haqqan wa adfa'a batilan. He says, by Allah, this pair of sandal is dearer to me than ruling over you unless I am able to establish right or avert falsehood. Haq and batil, maintaining haq and, preventing falsehood. These are the important purpose by which you should have a government. And if you are not able to fulfill that, it's not even worth more than that old, worn-out, pair of sandals of Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali bin Abi Talib alayhi salatu wassalam.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Ali حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صل عليه.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In the midst of a national shortage of N95 masks, the U.S. government quietly granted an exception to its export ban on protective gear, allowing as many as 5 million of the masks per month to be shipped overseas. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Christina Jewett, correspondent at Kaiser Health News. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Workers Cried Out for More Masks. The government allowed N95 exports anyway. Here's more. In the midst of a national shortage of N95 masks, the U.S. government quietly granted an exception to its export ban on protective gear, allowing as many as 5 million of the masks per month to be shipped overseas. The Federal Emergency Management Agency issued the waiver in the final moments of Donald Trump's presidency last month, allowing a Texas company to export its products after it failed to secure U.S. customers, according to FEMA letter obtained by KHN. National Nurses United President Zanny Trunfo-Cortez called the export waiver unconscionable and said N95s remain under lock and key in many hospitals. She said she still has to beg for a new N95 if hers gets soiled during a shift caring for COVID-19 patients. Healthcare employers and a federal agency that is supposed to be protecting the people of America are not doing their jobs, she said. They have no regard for American people's safety. The disconnect between frontline workers going without better protection and federal officials suddenly exporting masks boils down to one thing, workplace safety experts say. The government has not pivoted quickly enough to lift supply chain crisis mode guidelines and force employers to take costly and sometimes cumbersome steps to better protect workers with top quality gear. The FEMA letter references the challenge that Fort Worth-based Prestige Ameritech faced in finding customers for its government-approved high-end respirators. Hospitals did not want to fit test employees to its N95s, a 15-minute process per employee to ensure that a new N95 model seals to the face, according to company president Mike Bowen. Bowen said he ramped up N95 production during the pandemic from 75,000 to 9.6 million per month. Lately, he said he can't sell them to major buyers, does not have the infrastructure to sell them to small buyers, and has so many in storage that he may need to lay off workers and wind down production. The FEMA letter references those challenges and says the waiver was granted in the national defense interest to ensure he keeps production running at pace. The letter was transmitted to Border Patrol officials who oversee exports 103 minutes before Joe Biden was sworn into office. Yet even with the waiver, Bowen said he hasn't been able to find an overseas buyer. He said he can't understand the contradictory information he is getting. Frontline workers say they need more N95s, but hospitals say they don't. There is a disconnect someplace, and I don't know where it is, Bowen said. Why aren't my phones ringing off the hook if there is a shortage? A FEMA official said by email that the waiver could be revoked at any time if U.S. demand increases and that the agency could require the company to satisfy domestic demand before exporting N95s. Although prices fall considerably for those buying in bulk, prices for smaller lots of N95s have reached $4 to $7 each, according to GetUs PPE, a nonprofit meant to match frontline workers with needed gear. The requirement for employers to perform fit tests annually was set aside amid the public health emergency, giving employers little incentive to veer from the industry standard models like 3M that were used for years. And the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has left guidelines in place that say a limited cadre of health care workers should get N95s, which can be reused and rationed. That adds up to an unusual situation in which U.S. mask supplies have surged, but employers' motivation to buy the best protective gear has not, said Peg Seminario, a former union health and safety official who recently signed a letter urging the CDC to update its guidelines to reflect the risk of inhaling the virus. "This is crazy," she said. "We could crush this pandemic where the biggest risks of infection are, and we are not doing it." Started by a group of emergency room doctors in March, GetUs PPE said it gets 89% of requests for gear, often N95s, from health workers outside of hospitals like community clinics, COVID testing sites, and psychiatric care facilities. Demand rose throughout January, with 28% of frontline workers seeking N95s reporting that their site had none. Yet the volunteer-run group has been able to fulfill only about 15% of the requests it receives. Dr. Ali Raja, a founder of the group and executive vice chair of the emergency department at Massachusetts General Hospital, said the need is vast outside of hospitals, but small facilities scrambling for gear are not connecting to bulk sellers like Bowen's firm. "There was nothing out there. No centralized place for all facilities to best data on this. We want that to be the federal government." On the last day of 2020, FEMA extended its rule prohibiting anyone from exporting PPE, including N95s, without first getting express approval from the agency. The rule says the fall and winter surge in COVID cases meant domestic supply of allocated PPE has not kept pace with demand and is not anticipated to do so. The U.S. Strategic National Stockpile has not yet met its goal for N95 respirators, according to a U.S. Government Accountability Office report. The report said that as of December 18th, there were 190 million N95 respirators in storage, well short of its goal of 300 million. GAO remains deeply troubled that agencies have not acted on recommendations to more fully address critical gaps in the medical supply chain, the government watchdog report says. Another twist to the saga is that millions of counterfeit N95s stamped 3M, an industry standard that has long been used in previously required annual fit tests, have flooded hospital shelves even as federal agents rush to seize them at U.S. ports. A prominent group of scientists wrote to the CDC recently to point out guidelines that urgently need to be changed to protect workers from inhaling tiny airborne virus particles. Their letter noted that the CDC does not recommend the use of N95 respirators outside healthcare settings, even though outsized risks are documented for bus drivers, prison guards, and meatpacking staffers. CDC guidelines also allow hospitals to limit which workers get the N95s, leaving out those in community setting and lower-level workers who typically spend the most time next to patients. In the Laws on the Frontline project, KHN and The Guardian have documented the deaths of hundreds of more than 3,440 frontline health workers, of whom 2 in 3 were workers of color and 56% worked outside of hospitals. For more than 120 who died, family members had concerns about PPE, including the extensive reuse of N95s or the use of surgical masks for direct care of COVID patients.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghodde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a televised speech delivered on January 8, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, on the anniversary of an uprising led by the people of the city of Qom on January 9, 1978.
The issue of treacherous and malicious sanctions. Those days, the 19th of day, we were not well equipped, but today we are equipped with the intellectual, practical, political, and thankfully military weapons. We have also overcome many obstacles, and the goal is to establish a new Islamic civilization. This is our ultimate goal. It is possible that one generation may not achieve this, but the path will continue by Allah's favor. Future generations will attain this goal. We should overcome imperialist transgressions and vicious policies that they formulate against our country. Our positions against the US government originate from this outlook, this argument, and this philosophy. These points were about the 19th of day. As for the current affairs of the country, one of the most repeated issues in the challenge between the Islamic Republic and the Front of Arrogance headed by the US is the issue of sanctions. Another issue is Iran's regional presence. Yet, another is Iran's defensive and missile power.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
They constantly say something and nag about it, and this side too says something in response. Of course, our officials have responded to the Front of Arrogance on all three issues, our military officials, our Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and our people, with their slogans have responded to them. But now, I wish to say the final and definite word in this regard. As for the sanctions, the Western Front and our enemies are obliged to stop the malicious move, imposing sanctions against the Iranian nation immediately. It is their responsibility to lift all sanctions. This is a treacherous and malicious move, and it is grave and unreasonable enmity against the Iranian nation. They are showing enmity not only towards the Islamic government or the administration, but also against the Iranian people. It is their responsibility to lift these sanctions immediately.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.